Well, thank you, Mr. Morker. I know Mr. Laus said that he was not going to complain about the heat, but I wanted to complain about it a bit. But then he went and brings us a message about being joyful, and now I'm not sure what to do. Well, good afternoon, everyone. In 1998 on HBO, there was a mini-series titled From the Earth to the Moon. Does anybody remember that show? Not many. It was a series of 12 episodes describing the efforts of our space program to reach the moon. Tom Hanks even provided an introduction to each one of the episodes. I just really liked this series. It was one of those television shows that one could categorize as mostly clean. I mean, you didn't have to turn away from any sexual activity or cold-blooded murders or anything like that. Now, the series did include the tragedy of Apollo 1, where the cockpit of the spacecraft caught fire on the launching pad, killing the astronauts on board. But I don't really categorize that as violence. If I look at the popular TV shows today, most are about, you know, crime, sex, violence, or mixtures of these or other things that are, biblically unclean. I'm not promoting this series as an expression of biblical truths or Christ-inspired messages or themes, but most TV shows these days are kind of like going through the buffet line at Red Lobster. I mean, we really wouldn't choose many of the entrees. From the Earth to the Moon was just a fascinating story about our space program and the people that overcame a seemingly impossible obstacle, getting to the moon and back. Each of the 12 episodes in this series started with a clip of President JFK stating, "We choose to go to the moon in this decade and do the other things, not because they are easy, but because they are hard." I think one of the reasons why I liked this series was because of this repeated opening statement in each episode. I mean, what a fascinating statement, right? I mean, it sounds bananas. Who chooses the difficult task over the easy one? I mean, how often are paths chosen because they are hard? That's like saying, I choose to mow my lawn with a pair of scissors. It's like saying, I choose to wash my clothes down at the river. I choose to eat my peas one at a time. But it's not quite the same thing as these examples, because we do have established ways to mow our lawns and wash our clothes and, eat our peas more efficiently. There wasn't, however, a way to go to the moon at that time. It's really not a spoiler alert to say that the Apollo missions did get to the moon. And when thinking about this recently, I started wondering about the vastness of creation. And eventually I asked myself this question: is God there on the moon? And after some thought, I concluded that no, he is not. I'm not saying that God could not be on the moon. I mean, God can do all things, and he is omnipresent. He's everywhere. But I don't think he's hanging out there with no one else on the moon. There's nobody there. Now, in support of this position, we won't turn to these examples, but we have 1 Corinthians 12:14, which reads, "For in fact the body is not one member, but many." Then we have Proverbs 18:1. I've referenced that before. A man who isolates himself seeks his own desire. He rages against all wise judgment. But even at the beginning of the Bible, in Genesis 2:18, we're told, "It is not good that man should be alone." Well, if God concludes that it is not good for man to be alone, I don't think he'd choose to be alone either. When Christ was killed and put in the ground for 3 days and three nights, I can imagine that this was a horrible experience for the Father. Not only did he sacrifice his son, but he was without that companionship for those 3 days and three nights. From what I gather in the Bible, this was the only time that they had been apart. I'd like to think that the angels did their best to comfort God during this time, but that must have been a hard void to fill, even if it was just 3 days and three nights, a small sliver in the vastness of eternity. Even though we are in the fall Holy Day season, I'd like to propose to us that when we gather for the night to be much observed during Passover season, we should acknowledge that Christ was dead and buried at that time. The Father was alone. While we gather together on this wonderful night of fellowship and companionship, we could perhaps offer words of comfort to our great Creator God during this time when he was without his Son. We would, after all, do such a thing for the least of our brethren. All right, back to the moon. Apollo 11 was when man first stepped foot on the moon in July of 1969. I was 4 years old at that time. I think I have some fuzzy memories of watching blurry cartoons on a black and white console TV with the rabbit ears. And I sort of remember riding this big horse of a dog we had called Nipper. But I don't remember the moon landing. I think God was there with those astronauts at that time. Christ, in fact, gives us this promise at the end of Matthew, where he states, and again, we won't turn there, but in Matthew 28:20, it includes the phrase, "I am with you always." But what about the midpoint between the earth and the moon? Or the massive void of space between the Milky Way galaxy and Andromeda, our nearest galaxy neighbor? In that void, that vacuum, is God there? And again, God is everywhere, but is he spending his time, his focus there? I don't think so. In a vacuum, there's nothing there to protect. There's nothing there to fellowship with, to instruct, and most importantly, there's nothing there to love. It's empty. I mean, that's basically the definition of a vacuum, unless you want to go with dictionary.com's definition of a vacuum, which is a space devoid entirely of matter. The title of this message is Vacuum. Now, that's a hard word for me to spell. I'm always spelling it V-A-C-C-U-M, but it's actually spelled V-A-C-U-U-M. And every time Microsoft Word has to correct me, every time. Now, I sort of like that dictionary.com's definition, a space entirely devoid of matter. Well, taking this literally, there's nothing in a vacuum. There are no atoms, no molecules, no air, no Cool Ranch Doritos, no Hot Pockets, or anything. There's nothing in a vacuum. But taking the definition figuratively, a space devoid entirely of matter, implies that nothing matters in a vacuum. Well, we'll see if that's true or not. Now, there are geeks in the science community who believe that there is no such thing as a pure or true vacuum. And by the way, it's okay for me to call them geeks because I myself am one. And I think some of you are as well. But there's this Heisenberg uncertainty principle that states that a vacuum has non-zero energy, which implies something is there. But aside from arguments like this that go way over my head in the first place, the space between planets and stars make up the vast majority of creation. I mean, the vast majority, over 99%. In fact, it's calculated to be 99.999999, and I'll stop there, but I'd have to go to 39 nines after the decimal place. That's the percentage of what a vacuum is of creation. Now, that's near the percentage of when I'm hungry and I drive by a Taco John's and I swing in. Now, I remember in science class in high school, we had this machine that would pump air out of a container, creating a vacuum. Well, maybe some of you or maybe all of you did this too, and it's not as remarkable as I think it is. You put a marshmallow in a jar and suck the air out to create a vacuum, and the marshmallow would expand. It would get huge. Now, at that time, I initially thought that, hey, vacuums are going to solve all food shortage problems in the world. You know, you can put some Cool Ranch Doritos in a vacuum, and based on the marshmallow results, I'd expect them to get like 10 times bigger. So but when the air was let back in and the atmospheric pressure returned, the marshmallow was reduced again to its normal size. And it tasted the same, too. I mean, I was performing experiments. I had to verify the taste factor as well. Well, you know, Christ can certainly multiply bread and fish for a big crowd, but vacuums cannot. Are there any Robert Frost poetry fans here? Well, his poem, Mending Wall, has the line, "Something there is that does not love a wall." I think even if you don't really know any poetry of Robert Frost, maybe you've heard that line before. I sort of think something there is that does not love a vacuum either. With a space devoid of matter, matter wants to fill that space. The marshmallow in the jar was a really good example of this. But here's a better one. Matthew 12. We'll read verses 43 through 45. Matthew 12, verses 43 through 45. Matthew 12, starting in verse 43. When an unclean spirit goes out of a man, he goes through dry places, seeking rest, and finds none. Then he says, "I will return to my house from which I came." And when he comes, he finds it empty, swept and put in order. Then he goes and takes with him seven other spirits more wicked than himself. And they enter and dwell there. And the last state of that man is worse than the first. So shall it also be with this wicked generation. I mean, what a perfect example of a vacuum here. The unclean spirit leaves, and there's a void in that space. When it returns, it finds the emptiness still there. It's curious that the Bible states that when the unclean spirit left, it sought rest. 1 Peter 5:8 states that Satan prowls around like a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour. And at the beginning of Job, Satan said he was going to and fro on the earth. I just touched on that a couple of weeks ago. So the point of the sentence was not that the unclean spirit was seeking rest, but the point was that it found none. And that should not be a surprise. Satan is not content. The devil is not satisfied. Rest is not something that he or his followers seek. Maybe you are aware of verses in the Bible that talk about Satan seeking rest or being content. I could only find verses that maybe imply this, and that's a stretch. But we can prove that the devil does not seek rest or is not content in this way. 1 Timothy 6, we'll read verses 6 through 8. If you want to join me in 1 Timothy 6, we'll read verses 6 through 8. 1 Timothy 6, starting in verse 6. Now godliness with contentment is great gain, for we brought nothing into this world, and it is certain we can carry nothing out. And having food and clothing, with these we shall be content. Now we won't turn there, but there's also Psalm 23:1. I mean, we know this. The Lord is my shepherd. I shall not want. I shall be content. In fact, there are countless verses that talk about God's children being content, and ones where we are given peace and rest. And there are also many verses that instruct us that we should be seeking contentment and seeking peace. And of course, there is the Sabbath day, the day of rest. Well, Satan, the opposite of God, would then not want peace, rest, or contentment. If there is a way God wants us to be, Satan wants us to be the opposite of that. All right, back to the unclean spirit. The unclean spirit returned to the man and found the man had kept that space available. The void, the vacuum, was not filled by that man. I mean, the unclean spirit was not going to wait around until a no vacancy sign lit up. It settled back into that newly cleaned room and even brought his rowdy friends with him. You know, the ones with the loud rap music and the constant ruckus. I did read a lot of research on the idea of how to fill a void or a vacuum left by dropping a bad habit or an addiction. Now, we just read about the unclean spirit in the man from Matthew 12. The spirit was probably a bad habit or an addiction, more so than a one-time sin. I got the feeling the unclean spirit was dwelling in this man for a while. And the fact that it returned, it points to a relapse, which again likely identifies a bad habit or an addiction. There were a few noteworthy comments that I found about filling voids or vacuums. I want to share a couple of them with you. The first one was, temptation will remain in the mind until other priorities are relearned. Temptation will remain in the mind until other priorities are relearned. And the second comment, it's actually two sentences, so I'll just repeat the first sentence. The void left by stopping an addiction was created by the addiction in the first place. The void left by stopping an addiction was created by the addiction in the first place. If your focus becomes the void, you are not over the addiction. If your focus becomes the void, you are not over the addiction. Now, I find that last statement to be profound. It's easy to throw out the advice, just replace a bad habit with a good one. Exercise, that takes the mind off things. Call up a friend and have your friend distract you with conversation, you know, things like this. But the focus should be on the good habits developed or relearned rather than simply trying to fill the vacuum. If your focus becomes filling the void, you will tend to relapse. Focus on what is good, in other words, instead of not that which is bad. Now, we won't turn there, but we have this instruction to focus on the good, Colossians 3:2, which reads, set your mind on things above, not on things on the earth. It sort of complements Mr. Lausted's message earlier. We relearn our priorities by following this instruction. We focus on what is good. That is how you fill a vacuum. That lights up the no vacancy sign. You know, the Matthew 12 example of the unclean spirit is an example of a vacuum here on earth. Where there is a void, it will be filled. The marshmallow and vacuum will want to fill that jar. Bad habits will want to return. Vacuums on earth will be filled. But a vacuum in space is just the opposite. A vacuum in space does not try to be filled. It's just the opposite. The gravitational pull of stars and black holes work to create more space with emptiness. I mean, comets and meteors whizzing by get pulled into larger celestial objects, and the comets and meteors get absorbed. A planet or star will draw matter towards itself, creating more of nothing in space. But more so, science has determined that the universe is expanding. The Wikipedia page titled Metric Expansion of Space estimates that the rate of expansion is 67 kilometers per second. Space.com has the estimate at 71.9 kilometers per second. Now, none of this really has any significance to me other than the vacuum of space is getting larger. Galaxies get further away from each other over time, so there's more space between them, empty space. Nothing is trying to fill that empty space, that vacuum. The dictionary.com definition of a vacuum again, a space entirely devoid of matter. And if we again take this figuratively, nothing matters in a vacuum, right? Is that true? God is not in the vacuum in space. Again, not that he could not be. There's just nothing there for him to work with. Nothing in the Bible points to God being aloof, arbitrary, inconsistent, or applying himself to anything meaningless. God is purposeful. He's a planner and he's an architect, working on a scale beyond our ability to comprehend. He is not concerned with the nothingness of a vacuum in space. And he is not terribly concerned about the moon either. So in space, nothing really matters in a vacuum. But it's a different story here on earth. We are here, God's children. He's got a plan and purpose for us, and that matters to God. So the vacuum, the emptiness that we can have in our lives is not something God wants. He wants our lives to be full, and our thoughts to be full, and our hearts to be full. And he tells us what he wants us to fill our lives, our thoughts, and our hearts with. I mean, in a word, it comes down to love. God does not want a vacuum here on earth. Satan, however, loves a vacuum here on earth. He is the opposite of God, after all. Whether it is our time, our thoughts, or our hearts, the devil prowls around like a roaring lion seeking to fill our voids. He is careful and thorough and doesn't miss a thing. If there's a tiny void, a small empty space, he will find it and he will take root. And as we learn in Matthew 12, the unclean spirits are tough to evict. Ecclesiastes 3. Let's pick up where Mr. Lausted left off this morning. Ecclesiastes 3. We'll read verses 9 through 13. Ecclesiastes 3, verses 9 through 13. Ecclesiastes 3, starting in verse 9. What profit has the worker from that in which he labors? I have seen the God-given task with which the sons of men are to be occupied. He has made everything beautiful in its time. Also, he has put eternity in their hearts, except that no one can find out the work that God does from beginning to end. I know that nothing is better for them than to rejoice and to do good in their lives, and also that every man should eat and drink and enjoy the good of all his labor. It is the gift of God. Solomon here states that God gives us tasks to occupy ourselves, and that God has made everything beautiful in its time, and that we are to rejoice and do good and enjoy the fruits of our labor. It is, after all, a gift of God. These are Solomon's words here. These are God's words here. God has given us plenty to do to fill voids that may be in our lives, from careers in the workplace to school to careers at home, which most definitely include raising children, probably the most important job on the planet. We work. And then we enjoy the rest, the contentment that comes with labor. But aside from the work that comes with sustaining our existence, there's more we have been given to do. I mean, read the Gospels to get a glimpse of the life of Christ and what he did. He had many God-given tasks, and so do we. Call a friend. You know, write a letter to someone on a prayer list. Volunteer for something. Perform an activity for the benefit of someone else and expect nothing from it, at least for now. We get our rewards now or later, and later is better. But actually, Solomon identifies that the reward comes now as well. Work, perform our God-given tasks, tasks that Christ helped us to identify and realize, and then enjoy and rejoice. The work itself is the reward. And I know you know what I mean, because we all feel pretty good when we perform a good work. So the reward is later, and it is now. In what we read in Ecclesiastes 3, notice that it didn't focus on avoiding sin or avoiding bad habits or addictions. The focus is on doing good, working, performing God-given tasks, rejoicing, and enjoying the fruits of our labor. The focus is not on avoiding what is bad, but rather the focus is what comes from above, as we read in Colossians 3:2. If we do these things, there is no vacuum. The Bible does not teach us to reserve an empty space in our hearts and our minds. God is not in the vacuum in outer space, and he is not in the vacuum we could leave inside of us. Evil seeks out the empty space we have in our hearts and minds. And it's a hard tenant to evict. You know, property managers point out how very difficult it is to evict a lousy renter. Everything, it seems, is on the side of the renter. Even when the renter pulls out the copper plumbing from the walls or steals or damages the cabinets and appliances. The unclean spirit in Matthew 12 is a great parallel to this. Now, there are many ways to keep the unclean spirits out of our hearts and minds. Should we avoid the things out there that will do us harm? Should we run away from evil? Should we constantly remind ourselves of the dangers of the devil's way of life and his tactics? Well, yes, absolutely. But just doing these things will leave a vacuum. The act of avoiding evil will not sufficiently fill our hearts and minds. Let me say that again. The act of avoiding evil will not sufficiently fill our hearts and minds. Solomon shares with us what we are to do in what we read in Ecclesiastes 3. Let's keep our God-given tasks in the forefront of our minds, and it will fill our hearts as well. The Feast of Trumpets was 2 days ago, and coming up are the Day of Atonement and the Feast of Tabernacles. We are coming to the climax of God's fall holy day season. And what better time for us to reflect on how we are performing our God-given tasks? Because there is a reward for fulfilling our responsibilities. There is rest earned from this and rejoicing in reflecting upon the work. It's hard to keep evil away or evict the evil tenants that have taken up residence within us. President Kennedy said that we choose to go to the moon because it is hard. You know, we are no strangers to choosing a difficult path. We know what it's like. But the more we focus on filling our lives and the lives of those around us with good, the less we need to fight the wiles of the devil. Having no vacuum for evil will result in rewards to come. But it is also no coincidence that there are rewards we receive now for completing the God-given tasks that should make us all rejoice. You know, that was the end of my message, but on my way over here today, I was thinking about this message and the upcoming Feast of Tabernacles. I'd like us to be mindful of the individuals that we may see at the feast, people that are alone by themselves. I've been alone at feasts, and I know some of you have as well. There could be a companionship void in individuals we see at the feast, and we can help fill that void. It's easy for me personally to start a conversation with strangers, but not everybody's like that. Initiate conversations with individuals. Invite them along to an activity or a dinner. Help fill their potential void. You'll enhance their feast experience, and I'm sure you'll get something out of it as well. Let's just help each other with the vacuums that we may have. Have a blessed Day of Atonement and an awesome Feast of Tabernacles.